few days your stomach will adapt to the new reality. Any hunger pangs you feel early on will fade, and you'll reset your perception of full. 6. Don't eat anything white. White flours and white sugars are the enemy. That means that foods like white breads, cookies, white pasta, white rice, and white potatoes are out. The same is true for white fats like butter and full-fat cheese. Then just replace the white stuff with vegetables, fruits, and lean proteins. You'll lose a couple pounds, at least, just from taking this one step. 7. Make sure every meal is healthy. Easier said than done, right? Nope. Easily done. Just include a serving of lean protein, fish, poultry, egg whites, etc., with 2 servings of vegetables or 1 serving each of vegetables and fruit. Will that require a little planning? Of course it will. So every day, map out what you will eat the next day and buy, and even prepare your food ahead of time, if possible. Then, when it's time to eat, you won't have to make any decisions about what to eat. You'll just eat what you planned. Remember, decisions are behavioral change killers, so eliminate as many decisions as possible. And notice, you aren't counting calories. I didn't. If you eat healthy meals and don't add a lot of butter, dressings, toppings, etc., the calories basically take care of themselves. Besides, you already know the foods you shouldn't eat. You don't need a calorie app to tell you. 8. Toss in a snack. Eating less at every meal and eliminating white foods will leave you hungry at odd times of the day. I ate a protein bar for a mid-afternoon snack. Simple, convenient, and easy to eat on the go. Remember, snacking with a purpose is smart. Snacking just to snack is not. 9. Burn about 500 extra calories a day. Note that I said extra. If you already work out, then those calories are already factored into your daily routine and result in your current weight. So, you'll need to burn more calories. How? That's up to you. But keep in mind that unless you're a high-intensity workout fool, you'll need to work out for at least an hour to burn 500 calories. Walking at a brisk 3.5 miles per hour burns only 300 to 400 calories an hour, depending on your weight. Cycling is my favorite exercise for burning calories. If I average between 16 and 18 miles per hour and toss in some decent hills, I can easily burn 700 to 800 calories an hour. What you do is up to you, but you need to do whatever you decide to do. Burning an extra 500 calories a day, as long as you don't increase your calorie intake, will strip off about 4 pounds by the end of the month, and you'll be less likely to overeat at mealtimes because you won't want to spoil the hard work you put in. There are plenty of exercise calculators you can use. Pick one, pick some activities, and get to work. 10. Cheat wisely. Like sweets? Me too. But sweets are all about taste, and taste can be quickly satisfied. I let 3 or 4 chocolate chips melt in my mouth, one at a time, after some of my meals. The calories were negligible, but the taste was nice, and I felt a little less like a food monk. 11. Keep a food journal. The Hawthorne effect works. When we know we are being observed, we instinctively change our behaviors. In this case, of course, you will be the one doing the observing. Plus, writing down everything you eat will keep you from doing any mindless eating and will keep you from underestimating, because we all underestimate, what you actually consume. So write everything down. Then, total up your calories at the end of the day. Ideally, you'll eat 400 to 500 fewer calories than you did before you started, and at the end of the month, that will be worth 4 pounds or so. 12. Check off each step in the process. Notice I said process, not progress. The key is not to focus on your goal. The key is to focus on following your process. So make yourself a chart and check off each time you follow the process. Early morning exercise. Check. Almonds before meals. Check. Glass of water before meals. Check. Stop when full. Check. No white foods. Check. Every meal healthy. Check. Smart snack. Check. Burn 500 extra calories. Check. Cheat wisely. Check. What if you miss a check or two? It's not the end of the world. But it is reason to adjust your daily routine to ensure that tomorrow you can check off every box. I quickly realized I needed to prepare all my meals the night before, so I was never caught short. I also bought a box of protein bars and a bag of almonds to put in my backpack, so I would never be without. And because my schedule, like yours, was often unpredictable, I realized the only way I could be absolutely sure to exercise every day was to get up early and do it first thing. I used the 20-minute cardio period as a warm-up, and then rode my bike or jogged afterward. While it wasn't fun to get up early, it was fun to always complete that task. I got to feel good about myself every day for completing all the other tasks, and at the end of each day, for knowing that I had followed my process and achieved everything I had set out to achieve that day. Lose 10 pounds in a month? After a few days, it didn't sound like such a huge hurdle. I knew as long as I put in the work, I would make it. Every day put me one step closer. All I had to do was work the plan, and success was inevitable. Inevitable success is the best success of all, and it will happen when you set your goal, forget your goal, and focus on working your process. As long as, of course, the process you create will realistically help you achieve your goal. It's easy to get swept up in a dream and ignore the fact that your approach must be realistic. For example, let's say you want to become a multimillionaire. Want to get rich? You can. Completing all the steps required to run a marathon takes months. Completing all the steps to lose 10 pounds in 30 days takes, well, 30 days. Building exceptional wealth, that takes years. Getting rich, however you define rich, is an incredibly ambitious goal. Call it a life goal. How do you achieve a lifelong objective? Let's say your target is, oh, $50 million. Totally unrealistic? Nope. The goal isn't unrealistic. Genetics don't play a part. Experience, education, and connections are all important, but not required. Tens of thousands of people from all walks of life achieve that level of wealth. The goal isn't unrealistic, but for the millions of people who hope to achieve significant wealth, the approach is what is unrealistic and what ensures that they never come close. Of course, money isn't everything. As John D. Rockefeller, America's first billionaire, said, "If your only goal is to become rich, you'll never achieve it." His point is well taken. If the only thing you care about is making money, no matter how much money you make, it will never be enough. Still, even though we each define and calculate success differently, as well we should, most of us would like wealth to factor into our equation somewhere. The best way to determine the right process for achieving a life goal is to study people who have actually achieved that goal. Why reinvent the wheel? Start at the end and work backward. In this case, we'll use top 400 individual tax returns reporting the largest adjusted gross incomes, a report the IRS issues on an irregular basis. Reading the report is as exciting as the title sounds. The IRS Statistics of Income Division is evidently where fun goes to die. But if you want to get rich, there is some interesting data buried in all the charts and tables. As of this writing, the latest report I could find was for 2009, which to you and me seems like a long time ago, but to the government clearly seems up to date. In 2009, it took $77.4 million in adjusted gross income to make the top 400, and that amount only just let you crack the list. The average earnings on the list were $202.4 million. Where it gets interesting is how the top 400 made their money. Wages and salaries, 8.6%. Interest, 6.6%. Dividends, 13%. Partnerships and corporations, 19.9%. Capital gains, 45.8%. The top 400 averaged $92.6 million in capital gains. That's 16% of the total capital gains reported by all taxpayers. Do the math, and the whole one percenter thing that was popular a few years ago sounds like an overestimate. Obvious conclusions. Working for a salary won't make you rich. Neither will making only safe income investments. Neither will investing only in large companies. Owning a business or businesses, even in part or partnership, not only could build a solid wealth foundation, but could someday generate a huge financial windfall. The data clearly supports the last point. A total of over 3,800 taxpayers have made the top 400 since 1992, but only 27% appear more than once, and only 2% appear 10 or more times. But you say you don't trust the IRS? Fine. Check out the top 10 people on the annual Forbes Billionaires list. Whom do you find? The usual suspects. Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, Larry Ellison, David and Charles Koch, a collection of Walmart, Waltons, Sheldon Adelson, proving, as if you need proof, that no one wins in casinos but the casinos, all entrepreneurs. I worked my way down into the 200s, and when I still couldn't find an employee, I got bored and quit looking. Clearly, getting rich in financial terms is the result of investing in yourself and others, taking risks, doing hundreds of small things right, and then doing one or two big things really, really right. Happier and wealthier. Here's a funny thing. I've spoken to dozens of successful entrepreneurs, and all of them do the same thing. When we talk about the financial side of being an entrepreneur, exit strategies, revenues, IPOs, the ever-popular cashing out, they're interested but far from animated. But when we talk about the life of an entrepreneur, when we talk about how it feels to be an entrepreneur, every one of them lights up. They enthuse about the challenges, the responsibility, the sense of mission, the sense of purpose, the sense of fulfillment and excitement of working with and for a real team, the amazing feeling of empowerment and control over their own destinies. It happens every time. The bootstrappers, the ones with infinite dreams but at least for the moment negligible revenues, light up. The successful entrepreneurs, like Joel Gascoigne, who helped expand Buffer from a personal project into a thriving business with a talented team, real revenues, and significant investment capital, light up. The hugely successful entrepreneurs, like Scott Dorsey, who helped steer Exact Target out of a garage into an IPO and then into an acquisition by Salesforce.com, light up. Dharmesh Shah, the co-founder of HubSpot, who took his vision of the future of marketing and turned it into a public company with a market capitalization of over $2 billion, lights up. Every entrepreneur lights up when we talk about being an entrepreneur. Because as entrepreneurs, they feel alive. They feel free to chart their own courses, to make their own decisions, to make their own mistakes, to let the sky be the limit, not just financially, but also, and almost always more importantly, personally. Hugely successful or barely off the ground, they haven't just started businesses, they've become something. They've become entrepreneurs. And they already feel rich, regardless of income or wealth. But if they hope to become wealthy in monetary terms, they are on the right track, because barring some stroke of financial lightning that no one could foresee, There is no way to accumulate millions of dollars in wealth unless you start your own business. Maybe that business is selling a product or service. Maybe that business is day trading. Maybe that business is becoming an actor or musician or entertainer or writer or any of a number of professions where you are in the business of you. Actors get hired to play roles, so technically they work for someone else, but not really. Fundamentally, actors, just like musicians and other entertainers, are in the business of themselves. The only way to become financially rich is to start your own business, even if it's just on the side, even if it's just, at first, a slightly stepped-up hobby. Any other approach will not make you rich. If you want to amass significant wealth, but you aren't willing to give up your current job, or spend your nights and weekends building a side business with considerable potential, your approach is the problem. Say your goal is to have $2 million in the bank. If you earn $50,000 a year in salary, a very nice wage, and you don't spend a penny of it, and somehow manage not to pay any taxes either, it will still take 40 years to save $2 million. The goal isn't unrealistic. The approach, the process, is unrealistic. Or say you want to amass tens of millions of dollars in wealth. If you aren't willing to work to create something new and different, if you aren't trying to do something Zuckerbergian, your goal isn't the problem. Your approach is the problem. If you aren't willing to find a new way to fill an ongoing and nearly universal need, if you aren't willing to do something Netflixian, your goal isn't the problem. Your approach is the problem. You can't just open a corner restaurant and hope to become super wealthy. You can't stop there. You'll have to build a chain of restaurants. You can't just open a small boutique downtown. You can't stop there. You'll have to build an online clothing empire. And if you think everything I've just told you sounds depressing, that I'm crushing your dreams before you even start, you're wrong. Everything I've just told you is totally empowering. If you want to become wealthy, there is a way. If you want to achieve a huge goal, whatever your goal may be, there is a way. Especially when you use the power of language to help you stay on track. "I don't" are the magic words for staying on track. I know what you're thinking. Fine. But how will I ever stick with that process for a month when I always struggle to change my diet for one day? That's a good question. Changing your behavior, especially when doing something different, basically means saying no to something you normally do, is really hard. Most people trying to change their diet and exercise routine slowly chip away at their own resolve until they wind up doing something they didn't want to do, because they eventually couldn't say no to themselves. That's one of the toughest parts of following a process, or creating a new habit, or simply trying something new and difficult, saying no to yourself. You want to take a day off and you can't say no to yourself. You want to have dessert and you can't say no to yourself. You want to run farther, but you feel tired and you give in and don't say no to yourself. And you end up doing what you didn't plan to do, or not doing what you planned to do. So what is the best way to say no to yourself? It's easy. Stop saying can't and start saying don't. It works. Science says so. Researchers conducted a study. One group was given a simple temptation and told to say, in the face of that temptation, "I can't do that." The other group was told to say, "I don't do that." What happened? Participants told to say "I can't" gave in to the temptation 61% of the time. Participants told to say "I don't" gave in to the temptation 36% of the time. Pretty cool, right? It gets better. The same researchers conducted a further experiment. Participants were told to set a personal, long-term health and wellness goal. When their initial motivation flagged, as initial motivation inevitably does, one group was told to say, "I can't miss my workout. Another group was told to say, "I don't miss my workouts." The control group was not given a temptation avoidance strategy. 10 days later, the researchers found 3 out of 10 control group members stuck to their goal. 1 out of 10 "I can't" group members stuck to their goal. 8 out of 10 "I don't" group members stuck to their goal. Not only was "I can't" less effective than "I don't," "I can't" was less effective than using no strategy at all. Why? According to the researchers, the refusal frame "I don't" is more persuasive than the refusal frame "I can't" because the former connotes conviction to a higher degree. Perceived conviction mediates the influence of refusal frame on persuasiveness. Or in language the rest of us understand, when we say "I can't," we give ourselves a way out. "I could, sure, but this time I'm choosing not to, you know, because I can't. Wait. I probably shouldn't, but, you know, maybe just this one time." Which of the following sound more powerful and affirmational? "I can't skip my workout today," or "I don't miss workouts." "I can't give you a discount," or "We don't discount our products." "I can't make time for that, so sorry," or "I don't have a single open slot in my calendar." "I can't" sounds tissue paper thin because it's a decision based on external reasons or causes. "I don't" sounds like a brick wall because it comes from deep inside you. It's part of your identity. It's who you are. The power of "I don't" extends to both your mindset and the impression you make on others. 1. You can't make excuses to yourself. Take "I don't miss workouts" or "I don't eat fast food." When you can't, you automatically start to find excuses, reasons why you can. When you don't, you automatically start to find ways to ensure you do, because that is the person you have become. That is the person you are. Use the power of language to help turn what you want to be into who you are. Use the power of language to forge a new and better identity for yourself. 2. You come across as more confident. Take "We don't offer discounts." Maybe you really don't want to offer discounts because your margins will suffer and competing on price is a slippery slope you can't afford. Instead of saying, weakly and apologetically, "I'm sorry, but we can't drop our prices any lower," say firmly and with conviction, "We don't offer discounts." And then either remain silent and wait for a response, or shift the conversation to what you are willing to do. Provide a quicker turnaround, or extend payment terms, or break a large order down into smaller shipments. Use "I don't" to ensure that what must be non-negotiable remains non-negotiable, and then shift to terms you are willing to negotiate. 3. You won't get as much pushback on your resolutions. Take "I don't have time right now." Say a friend of a friend says, "I'd love to work in your industry. Can we meet for coffee so I can get some advice?" You'd love to say yes, but sometimes that's impossible. Saying, "I'm sorry, but I can't," inevitably results in the other person saying, "But I promise it will only take a minute and it would mean so much to me." And then you're trapped. You either consent to meet or decline and come across as rude. Either way, you lose. Instead say, "I'm sorry, but I don't have time in the next few weeks. Give me your card and maybe we can work something out down the road." Then you can say yes, if you decide to say yes, on your terms. Here's a don't everyone should say. "I don't care what other people think." Most of the time we should worry about what other people think, but not if it stands in the way of living the life we really want to live. "I can't care? The heck with that. I don't care." You shouldn't care. It's your life. And there's only one option. Live it your way. Of course, being confident and respected starts with deciding who you want to be and that means choosing a goal to achieve. After all, we are not what we think or wish or dream. We are what we do. Let's figure out what you want to do. Chapter 4. Happiness comes to serial achievers. Encouraging you to live your best life is easy. Helping you decide what goals you should pursue and achieve in order to live that best life is a lot tougher. Easy now. I really like Oprah. That's why no one does it. But I will. Before I do, though, let's discuss a few other things. How good is good enough? First, let's pretend Malcolm Gladwell is right, and it takes approximately 10,000 hours of focused effort to become an expert in a challenging pursuit or field. Actually, first, let's pretend Malcolm Gladwell was actually the first to come up with the 10,000 hours premise. If Gladwell is basically right, and snarkiness aside, he always is, but I have better hair, so at least I've got that going for me, then the average person will need to put in about 40 hours a week for 5 years to become highly accomplished in their chosen pursuit. But most of us don't have 40 hours a week to devote to accomplishing a huge goal unless it's career-related, in which case we typically spend a huge chunk of our time performing skills we've already learned instead of developing new skills that will lead us to greatness. We're more likely to become superior in that career pursuit. Not world class, not top 0.01%, but definitely more skilled than 95% of the population. That's cool. You don't need to be a world class athlete to, cliche alert, run a marathon. But if that is a goal you set, and you achieve that goal, you will then have accomplished something that 99.999% of the population never will. Because the average person can successfully train to run a marathon in less than a year. When you think of it that way, achieving the rank of superior is an excellent alternative to applying Gladwellian levels of effort. Besides that, you don't want to try to become world-class in a variety of pursuits. It's incredibly difficult to perform at an extremely high level in very different and sometimes conflicting pursuits. As Gladwell said on Lance Armstrong's The Forward podcast, if you're the CEO of a company or an entrepreneur starting a company, you cannot optimize for any one attribute. The minute you do that, you compromise your ability to perform at a high level in another area. The job of running a complex organization or starting a business is all about 4 or 5 different things that have nothing in common. So being a good manager and optimizing the performance of any aspect of your company is often at odds. Being a good manager means saying to your employees, you do it. You take responsibility. Even though by definition they're not as good at it as you are. My editor at the New Yorker magazine, David Remnick, is a better writer than 95% of the people who work for him. He's constantly in this position of having to accept articles that are not as good as the ones he would write himself. If he were to be completely honest and say, I can't accept this, he wouldn't have a magazine. That's the triathlon problem. At a certain point, I have to say, I can't optimize for being an amazing runner because I have to worry about swimming or cycling. That's the same problem you face every day. Pay too much attention to any one aspect of your job and other aspects suffer. Work too hard on one area of your business and other areas suffer. Work too hard on any one aspect of your life and other aspects suffer. That's why it's so hard to be world class at anything, much less at several things. And that's why you don't need to be world class. Get to the 90 or 95% level in any pursuit and you will be extremely successful and will feel incredibly good about yourself. Perfection definitely isn't required. Generalists trump specialists in today's professional landscape. In fact, the pursuit of perfection is the enemy. That's even true on a professional level. The current professional landscape values generalists over specialists. Change occurs quickly. Skills that are valued today are obsolete tomorrow. Managers can't just be good at managing a certain function. They need to be good leaders. Employees can't just be good at performing a certain function. They need to embrace an entrepreneurial mindset and constantly reinvent themselves. When specific knowledge is more and more a commodity, and it is because information is more widely available than ever, the people who can synthesize and blend and apply a broad base of skills to a variety of functions and problems are the people who are most valued. More on that in a moment. It's okay to be a tortoise. But don't stress about learning to code and mastering Mandarin at the same time. Take a step back and think about your life in stages. If you're 30 years old, barring any unforeseen encounters with Gladwell's hair from which you do not escape, you should live to be approximately 80. And that means you have 8 to 10 5 to 7 year periods ahead of you. That means you have 8 to 10 different phases of your life that you can use to accomplish 8 to 10 huge goals. For the sake of argument, let's say that even though you can train for a marathon in a year or two, it does take you 5 to 7 years to accomplish your goal. That seems like a long time, but it's not. Even if 5 to 7 years are required to accomplish each goal, you have enough time to become a serial achiever, a person who accomplishes this, then that, then that, then that, all while working hard to succeed and advance in your career. That means you can become an, a person who is this, and this, and this, and this. A great example is Venus Williams. She's a highly accomplished tennis player, ranked the world's number one tennis player on 3 separate occasions, winner of 7 Grand Slam singles titles, winner of 14 Grand Slam doubles championships, 4-time Olympic gold medalist. I could go on and on. Her legacy as one of the all-time tennis greats is assured. What you may not know is that Venus has quietly crafted a successful career as an entrepreneur, launching her activewear brand, 11, a company that makes tennis clothing and performance women's clothing for yoga, fitness, running, and dance. 11 is anything but a celebrity vanity project. Venus is heavily involved in design, planning, operations, marketing. She even personally packages some orders, and when she does, she includes a card that reads, "Packed by Venus." That makes Venus Williams, like many highly successful people, a serial achiever. It's trendy to say the path to success lies in focusing on just one thing. Venus has never felt she should focus only on tennis. She feels she can be a tennis player and a student. She's pursuing a master's degree in interior architecture, and a designer, and an entrepreneur. Because most professional athletes focus solely on their sport, I asked her why she approaches her life differently. "To me, that's normal," she said. "From an early age, I had to figure out how to be amazing at what I did and do well in school at the same time. In my home, we weren't allowed just to be athletes. We had to be students, and our dad taught us to be entrepreneurs. We would drive to a tennis tournament somewhere, and he would put in a cassette about buying foreclosure properties. We were 8 and 9 years old, and we had to listen to how to make money on foreclosures. Obviously, we didn't understand much of it. That didn't really matter, because our dad was trying to establish that mindset of multitasking, of being an entrepreneur, of charting your own path. So for me, trying to excel at multiple things is normal." I also realized early on that even the longest athletic careers are actually really short. When you're an athlete, you're done early in life, so I decided to see that not as a limitation, but as an opportunity. So I've always been focused on having goals beyond tennis. I know what you're thinking. "That's fine for Venus, but I just don't have the time to do all those things." Bullshit. Yes, you do. Why you must be a professional serial achiever. Imagine someone asks, "What do you do?" How do you answer? Maybe you say, I own a restaurant, or I'm a supervisor at a manufacturing facility, or I'm a teacher. Whatever you say, your answer probably doesn't include the word and. But it should, even though there's often a stigma associated with being an and. Take me, not because this is all about me, but because I'm the only person I know a lot about. I'm a ghostwriter and author. I'm a speaker. I'm a productivity improvement consultant. Until recently, I was a wedding photographer. And I take on physical challenges from time to time. If I may say so, and what the heck, I will, I'm pretty good at all of those things, except maybe the physical challenges. But here's what happens. Say I do a speaking gig. Invariably, aspiring speakers will corner me afterward to talk about the business of speaking. Keen to fill in open cells on their revenue projection spreadsheets, they ask how many speaking engagements I do. I try not to do more than 20 or so a year, I answer. Only 20? Wow, you must get paid a lot for each event. It depends on how you define a lot, I say, but I don't want to do more than 20 a year. Why not? If you did more events, couldn't you make more money? They ask. Probably so, I say. But I'm also a ghostwriter. What? I'm a speaker and a ghostwriter, I say. Oh, they say. And their voices trail off as their perception of me changes. And that's before I told them I also photograph about 10 weddings a year. After all, successful people do one thing. Unsuccessful people need to do a variety of things to make ends meet. If I'm a speaker and a writer and a photographer, then surely I must not be particularly successful at any of those pursuits. So no matter what their initial impression of me as a speaker, no matter how big the event, no matter how sophisticated the audience, they no longer see me as a successful speaker simply because I don't speak on a full-time basis. In short, I must not be good enough to specialize. The same is true with ghostwriting. When I tell people I also do speaking gigs, they generally assume I have to take on those engagements because I'm a struggling writer forced to find other ways to earn money. To most people, professional specialization indicates accomplishment and success, when in fact the opposite is true. You, me, all of us, we're too good to specialize. Venus is too good to specialize. She is capable of more than tennis. She's too good to be just one thing. None of us should be just one thing. We all possess, or can possess, a variety of skills, including skills we aren't using. Don't say, I can't afford to spend the extra time on an and. You can't afford not to spend the time. If your and is professional, then you create a buffer against downturns, shifts in market conditions, or the loss of a job. If your and is personal, you get to add a little more fun to your life. And don't say, I don't know where to start because I don't know where I want to end up. One of the biggest reasons people don't start doing, well, anything, is that they think the first step must be a component in a comprehensive grand plan. One where every step is charted and every milestone identified. And because they don't have that plan, they don't start. As Eagles guitarist and eminent philosopher Joe Walsh says in the documentary History of the Eagles, as you live your life, it appears to be anarchy and chaos and random events, non-related events, smashing into each other and causing this situation or that situation. And then this happens, and it's overwhelming. And it just looks like, what in the world is going on? And later, when you look back at it, it looks like a finely crafted novel. But at the time, it don't. And please don't think it's too late. Maybe you're smart enough to listen to this book and create a professional life plan in your 20s. I wasn't. I didn't have a clue. Neither did Joe. Read stories of successful people, and it's easy to think they have some intangible something, ideas, talent, drive, skills, creativity, whatever, that you don't have. Nope. Success is inevitable only in hindsight. Success is never assured. Plans are never perfect. Only in hindsight does it appear that way. What really happens is that people do things, try things, succeed at things, fail at things, learn from those failures, learn from those successes, and along the way they seize and create opportunities to advance themselves so they can live the life that makes them happy. So go ahead. Be a professional serial achiever. Embrace your and. Take the steps that let you include an and in the way you describe yourself professionally. Think about what you do well, or would like to do well, and most important, would really enjoy doing. Don't choose an and you feel you should choose. Pick a side hustle your inner 20-year-old will love. Being a serial achiever is a chance to explore, to delve, to expand, even to indulge, but with a purpose. Maybe starting a small business on the side would be fun. Maybe teaching, or consulting, or working part-time, or volunteering, or going back to school would be fun. It doesn't matter what and you choose, as long as it is something you really want to do. Then you get to recharge and refresh, pick up new perspectives, and bring certain skills back to your primary role, or roles. Keep in mind, you don't have to start a totally new side hustle or embrace a completely new interest to be an and. You can strategically choose to add new skills to your skill set. If you work in an office filled with data analytics superstars, you can work on being the best communicator, especially in meetings where it's easiest for skilled communicators to stand out in the building. Then you won't be just another number cruncher. You'll be the one person who can not only glean insights, but also communicate those insights in a way that turns insight into action. After all, data without insight is just data. Or maybe you work in operations and it's hard to stand out based on numbers and results alone. Fine. Work to improve your sales knowledge so you can create projects that make the sales team's job easier. Faster turnaround, smaller production lots, increased product options, etc. When the sales folks are on your side, you're impossible to ignore. Plans are great, but plans without action are just dreams. Pick something you want to do and try it. As Seth Godin says, once you had to wait to be accepted, to be promoted, to be selected, to somehow be discovered. Not anymore. Access is nearly unlimited. You can connect with almost anyone through social media. You can publish your own work, distribute your own music, create your own products, or attract your own funding. You can do almost anything you want, and you don't need to wait for someone else to help you. The only thing holding you back is you and your willingness to try. Try something. Try anything. And trust that you're smart enough to decide whether it is right or how you can make it right for you. Then you'll be an and. Scratch that. Then you'll be a professional serial achiever. Then you'll have a number of ands included in the way you describe yourself. I promise it will be worth it. After all, in most cases, what comes after the first and will be one of the things you enjoy doing the most. Why you must also be a personal serial achiever. Unless you're a trust fund baby or off hugging trees, professional serial achievement is vital. We all must make a living, and to some degree, money is important. As Leonardo DiCaprio, as Howard Hughes, says to Katharine Hepburn's family in the movie The Aviator, "You say money doesn't matter to you, but that's because you've always had it." Of course, the need to make a living doesn't mean you must blindly pursue financial success. Success means different things to different people. We'll talk more about your definition of success in a moment, because determining that is a crucial factor in choosing the goals you decide to pursue. Still, some people feel that their only major goals should be of a professional or financial nature. Either way, do this for me. Take a moment and list a few of the things you've always wanted to accomplish, but haven't. Pick things that you regret never having done. Pick things that make you feel wistful to imagine. Write down 3 or 4. I'll wait. Now, tell me, how many of the things you just wrote down are professional goals? If you're like most people, none of them are. Not one involves career or money. Instead, they're personal goals. You feel less fulfilled because you haven't achieved them. And someday, you'll sit on your porch and deeply regret that you never did and never tried. The best goals eliminate the pain of regret. As we talked about before, some of the worst words you can say are, if I had only... Think about something you dreamed of doing 5 or 10 years ago, but didn't work to do. And think about how good you'd be at that thing today if you had. Think about all the time you wasted and can never get back. Now, project into the future and imagine you're 80 years old sitting in a rocker on your front porch, reflecting on your life, regretting that you never tried to do the things you wanted to do, and now you never will. A quote often attributed to Jim Rohn goes, "There are two types of pain you will go through in life, the pain of discipline and the pain of regret. Discipline weighs ounces, while regret weighs tons." Sure, the work is hard. Sure, the work is painful. But it's significantly less painful than thinking back on what will never be. That's why step 2 is to think about what you will most regret never having done. Keep in mind that nothing on that list will include work. No one lying on their deathbed thinks, if only I had spent more time at the office. You may regret not having worked to find more fulfilling or enjoyable work, but when you're on your deathbed, you will not regret failing to earn a more important title or snag a cooler office or make more money. Instead, you'll think about what would have made you feel happier or more fulfilled. When you're sitting in that rocking chair, you'll think about the things you wanted to become. That's why personal goals are important, not just to set, but to achieve. Achieving personal goals, no matter how silly, how frivolous, or how impractical, is rewarding. And as you pursue those goals, you meet new people, make new connections, build new friendships, and best of all, feel better about yourself. Those are all things we can use more of in life. Serial achievement makes you uncontainable, unpredictable, and undefinable. The beauty of serial achievement is that over time, you become more than one thing. You can be a web designer and a musician and an athlete. And then you can become something else as well, knowing that when you have achieved a certain level of skill or experience, you can work to achieve something else. Plus, the skill you gain will not be wasted if or when you move on to another pursuit. Except for unusual skills like tech skills, which are constantly on the verge of becoming obsolete even for full-time programmers and developers, the skills you gain will stay in your toolkit. While over time you will naturally lose some degree of proficiency, you will always retain the core skill and will be able to quickly tune yourself up again if necessary. Think of it this way. Strength is hard to build the first time, but regaining strength lost is much easier. And even if you do lose a significant amount of skill, that's okay. The confidence and fulfillment you gain from all your hard work and dedication will in themselves make your effort worthwhile. You will always be able to look back and think, I did that. A moment of accomplishment may be fleeting, but satisfaction lasts forever. Here's the key question. Are you happy? If I haven't convinced you that being a serial achiever is the best way to live a full, satisfying, and successful professional life and personal life, well, there's no hope for you. Okay, there is. There is always hope. Hope is one thing no one can take away from you. So let's take a second to talk about happiness. because goal achievement and happiness are inextricably intertwined. As I said before, success in business and in life means different things to different people. It should mean different things. Each person is unique, so everyone's definition should be unique. Ultimately, whether or not you feel successful depends on how you define success, and on the trade-offs you are willing to not just accept, but embrace as you pursue that definition of success. We can have a lot, but we can't have everything. That's why for an entrepreneur, or an employee, or a parent, or a retiree, to anyone, there is only one way to determine success. The answer lies in one question. How happy am I? How successful you feel is based solely on your answer to that question and the trade-offs required. For example, extremely successful, at least in terms of traditional business success, entrepreneurs work impossibly long hours while focusing almost exclusively on building their business. In many cases, some would argue most cases, their personal and family lives are to at least some degree casualties of that focus. Is that a fair trade-off? Fair or unfair is beside the point. Trade-offs are unavoidable. If you're making tons of money but are still unhappy, you haven't embraced the fact that incredible business success often carries a heavy personal price. Other things are clearly more important to you than making money, and that's okay. If, on the other hand, you leave every day at 4 o'clock and pursue a rich and varied personal life and you're still unhappy, you haven't embraced the fact, and it is a fact, that what you chose to do will not make you wealthy. Personal satisfaction is important, but it's not enough for you. And that's okay, too. We can try to compartmentalize all we want, but business success, family and friends, personal pursuits, no single aspect of our lives can ever be truly separated from the others. Each is a permanent part of a whole, so putting more focus on one area automatically reduces the focus on another. Want to make more money? Want more time with family? Want to help others? You can, but something else will have to give. The more money you want to make, the less happy you may need to be. The happier you want to be, the less money you may be able to make. In a perfect world, you could have full measures of both, but this is not a perfect world. That disconnect is what causes so many people to spend their lives thinking, is this all there is? That disconnect leads men in their 50s to wear gold chains and undo one too many shirt buttons and drive their new Corvette with the top down, even though it's 30 degrees outside. The problem isn't external. The problem isn't jewelry or clothing or cars. You can't have it all, but you can have a lot. At first, you must know what you really want. Be honest with yourself. What do you want to achieve for yourself and your family? What do you most value spiritually, emotionally, or materially? What do you most want to do? In what setting or what pursuit are you happiest? But don't automatically say that your family and friends are the most important thing in your life. If they are, that's great. But if they're not, and yet you're spending the bulk of your time and focus on those relationships, then you're only cheating yourself out of the chance to be happier by focusing on what is more important to you. I used family and friends as an example for a reason. We're conditioned to say that, or we think it's socially correct to say that, but there truly is no right or wrong answer. If you're more interested in professional success than in maintaining close friendships, that's okay. You're not a bad person. You're just you. There is only your answer. Whatever your answer may be, that is what makes you happy, and if you aren't doing it, you won't be happy. Sound too simple? Maybe. But think of all the people you know who complain about the results of the path they have clearly chosen. For example, we all know at least one high school teacher who constantly complains about low pay. I don't blame them. Teachers should be paid more. They have an incredibly important job. But they aren't paid more. and unless something dramatic happens, they won't be paid more. As Marlowe from The Wire would say, you want it to be one way, but it's the other way. Teachers may be woefully underpaid, but currently, that's the way it is. If you're not happy, rethink your definition of success. The one you have is not working for you. You can't have it all. You shouldn't want to have it all, because that's the best way to wind up unhappy and unfulfilled. But you can have a lot more than you currently do, whether what you want more of is professional or personal success. So start pursuing the goals that will make you happy. Maslow really did have his shit together. A guy in my neighborhood wanted to climb Mount Kilimanjaro. He hiked double-digit miles a few days a week. He spent hours and hours on a Stairmaster. He carried around backpacks full of water jugs to simulate a heavy pack. He devoted 20 to 25 hours a week to training. Good for him, right? Not really. During that same time, his house went into foreclosure. I know another guy who decided he wanted to become a chess grandmaster. The process involves a lot of study, playing a massive number of games, and constantly increasing your ranking by defeating better and better opponents until you qualify. He was definitely dedicated. He spent nearly all his free time trying to become one of the few, the proud, the grandmasters. Good for him, right? Not really. He got close. But then the combination of weighing more than 300 pounds and smoking 2 packs of cigarettes a day and getting zero exercise caught up with him. He had a heart attack and needed a double bypass, and his health is forever compromised. Lofty goals are great. I love lofty goals. Unusual goals are great. I love them too. Goals everyone else thinks are crazy, pursuits no one else but you may see as worthwhile, are great. We are all different, and so are our goals. But in one way, we are all the same. We all have certain basic needs. Maslow's hierarchy of needs lays out a theory that psychological health is based on fulfilling innate human needs in order of priority. Fulfill all the levels, and boom, you're self-actualized. I'm not as smart as Maslow, so my hierarchy is simpler. We all need to be healthy. We all need to maintain solid family relationships. And we all need a level of income sufficient to our needs. Not wants, needs. Those things are non-negotiable. And that's why this logical leap isn't a leap at all. If you currently aren't healthy, don't feel good about your primary relationships, or the people with whom you are in those relationships don't feel good about you and aren't making enough money, then you have no business taking on any goal that does not make one of those areas of your life better. It's impossible to feel fulfilled and happy if you aren't taking care of your basic needs. And it's impossible to actively pursue a goal that doesn't take care of a basic need that is lacking, because you will always feel guilty about spending time on it. If you aren't bringing in enough money to keep food on the table and a roof over your head, you'll feel guilty and selfish if you spend time training to climb Mount Kilimanjaro. If you're overweight and out of shape and struggling to perform normal daily tasks, you might not feel guilty or selfish about working toward becoming a grandmaster, but you should. Sometimes it's obvious we're being selfish. Other times, selfishness is harder to spot. Take me. I'm not a go-to-the-doctor kind of guy. I don't get regular checkups. I get a physical only when one is required for another reason. I don't go to the doctor for injuries unless my wife makes me. I figure time heals all wounds. I didn't even want to go to the hospital when I had a heart attack. After all, the first sign of a heart attack is denial. Luckily, I'm married to someone a lot smarter than me. So, where having a colonoscopy was concerned, no way. It was the last thing I wanted to do. Even though colon cancer is the second leading cause of cancer death, and even though screening for colon cancer is recommended for people once they hit age 50, because 90% of new cases occur in people 50 and older, and I was 54. And even though colorectal cancer almost always develops from precancerous polyps in the colon, and even though a colonoscopy allows a physician to detect and remove precancerous polyps